Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is Episode 7, More Than a Movie. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. I'm beyond excited for our topic for this episode. We'll be talking about the making of the movie Freedom Writers, written and directed by Richard LaGravenaise and starring Hilary Swank. For many of you, the Freedom Writers movie may have been your first introduction to the Freedom Writers and our story, and for that we are eternally grateful. As you can imagine, the process of taking our words and our book and turning them into a movie for the big screen was surreal and life-changing in so many ways. So we're going to be diving into that story with you today. First, we'll hear from one of our Freedom Writers, Tanya Payne, who will tell you about what it was like to have her words, her diary, represented on screen in the Freedom Writers movie. Next, we'll have a special edition of our Diary of the Day, read by Freedom Writer Maddie Comans, about the trust it takes to have someone tell your story. And lastly, our wonderful featured discussion is with screenwriter, director, and producer Richard LaGravenaise. He was the writer and director of our film, Freedom Writers, and over the years, he's become a trusted friend and confidant, both to me and the Freedom Writers. In our conversation today, Richard and I will be talking about the process of adapting our book, The Freedom Writers Diary, into a feature film, and the casting choices and the stories behind those talented kids who played my beloved students. We'll also discuss special behind-the-scenes moments that proved to all of us that this was more than just a movie. It was a movement. Thank you so much for listening. As you hear these stories, I invite you to think about what your story is and how you can use writing to lift and elevate others. Now, here's Tanya and some excerpts from the film Freedom Writers that bring her story to life.
Every school has their kind of gifted track, and from second grade, I was in that class atmosphere. So most of the time, I was the only Black student. I was put on a pedestal in a way, and it wasn't a place of honor.
I thought it would be most valuable to begin with Victoria to give us the Black perspective.
Victoria?
Do I have a stamp on my forehead that says the National Spokesperson for the Plight of Black People? How the hell should I know the Black perspective of the color purple? That's it. If I don't change classes, I'ma hurt this fool. Teachers treat me like I'm some kind of Rosetta Stone for African Americans. What? Black people learn how to read and we all miraculously come to the same conclusion?
That scene in the movie floored me. They used my words, and to see that verbatim, it got me a little bit emotional. It wasn't a big deal to anyone else, but it was a big deal to me, knowing that what I did in class was not just a reflection of my behavior, but it was a reflection of all Black people. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. I left, and it was probably one of the best decisions I've ever made.
Okay, everybody.
Going from the Distinguished Scholars Program at Wilson and being put in Aaron's classroom, it pushed me in ways that I was not anticipating. I've got a lot more confidence in who I am now and what I bring to the world because I'm a freedom writer. Somewhere, right now, there are hundreds of thousands of students who are being pigeonholed by their teachers. I hope that the movie gives them hope, but also I hope that it gives them power to not accept the limitations that others put on them. I hope that they take courage and heart and that they stand up for themselves, because there's power and there's joy in standing up for yourself, even in the face of so much opposition.
I love hearing my students, like Tanya, reflect on that amazing experience of turning their book into a movie. For the Freedom Writers, there are moments just like that, scenes in the film that resonate with them in such a special and personal way. To hear them talk about it and break it down, whether it's for kids in a classroom, through a video chat, or even young people who who are incarcerated in a juvenile hall is so sincere and so emotional. I'm so proud of who they've become and the stories they continue to tell. It takes a lot to be vulnerable, and there's a moment that every storyteller has to face. And that's the question of, can I trust my story with someone else? I remember asking myself that exact same question when I was first presented with the opportunity to turn the Freedom Writer story into a movie. So for this episode's Diary of the Day, I wanted to share a personal story with you. This is an excerpt from my memoir, Teach With Your Heart. In one chapter, I write about meeting Richard LeGravenaise for the first time and that daunting decision, do I trust him? Should we sign on to making our story into a film? The entry will be read by Freedom Writer Maddie Comins.
I was nervous about meeting Richard. I wanted to manage my expectations. Since so many people I met in positions of power were charismatic, I didn't want to lose myself to another persuasive personality. I told myself to play hard to get. When I walked into his office, I took one look at him and my heart melted. He was an unassuming writer, not a movie mogul. He immediately hugged me and said, "Gosh, I was so nervous about meeting you." I let my guard down. "Me too." So much for playing hard to get. I felt comfortable with him immediately. We seemed to have an easy and natural rapport. We began to talk about moments in film that affected us, like the little girl in Schindler's List, and the scene in Shawshank Redemption, where the old man plots a crime just so he can go back to prison. Richard believed in moments like that, a moment where people pause or feel compelled to get a cup of coffee after a film to dissect the scene. At that moment, I felt I can hand over my baby to him and it will be okay. His intentions seemed pure. "I will be honored to tell your story, Aaron, and I will try my hardest to do it justice." I felt his sincerity, and without hesitation, I said, "I trust you."
It was a privilege to be as involved as we were in making this film, and we can't believe it's been out in the world for over 10 years. What an honor it was that the film was so well received. Since the film was released, I've visited every single state in America and over 25 countries. On a recent trip to the Middle East, a young girl from the audience raised her hand, proudly announced that she'd seen the film 23 times, and that someday she was going to be the first female president of her country. Each and every time I hear one of those stories, it's humbling. Who would have thought that a simple movie could inspire and uplift and encourage somebody to dream the impossible dream? So if your life has been affected by the Freedom Writers movie in any way, we'd love to hear that story. We'll share it with the Freedom Writers or even Richard himself. So don't hesitate to write us an email. You can send it to podcast@freedomwritersfoundation.org. Now it's time for our feature discussion. So without further ado, here he is, Richard LeGravenaise, writer and director of the feature film Freedom Writers, joining me today in New York City at our publishing house, Penguin Random House. It is an honor for me to introduce our guest today, Richard LeGravenaise. I'm just so excited to allow our listeners to have a peek behind the curtain of this incredible film. And it was a journey. We met nearly 2 decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't aged a day.
Neither have you.
But I just am so excited to allow people who are familiar with the film to know the process. So I'd like to go back. The first time you and I met, we were going to meet and go have lunch at one of your favorite little cafes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an out-of-body experience for me because you had just worked on this great film that was nominated for an Academy Award. So we're sitting in this cafe talking about films. And I'll never forget, we kind of knew it was a perfect fit.
I've always favored female-driven stories. I think that partly is because I was raised by women. You know, I was raised by a family of women. I mean, I love my father, but he was a more distant figure to me than the women in my life. And so I learned everything from my, you know, older sisters and aunts and my mom. So actresses and what they can do in front of a camera, they fascinate me. Funny Girl came out when I was 9, and there was something about her. You know, I was from Brooklyn, and Streisand's from Brooklyn, and she was this outsider who, because of guts and talent and confidence, made it through in an enormous way. There was something very inspiring about that for a lot of us in Brooklyn who looked to theater and film as sort of, you know, across the river into New York. You know, all the talent and the fame and the creativity was something you'd reach for, and in Brooklyn, you're far, far, far away from it. And she was the first, I think, kind of hero for me, in a way, to see what was possible with confidence and talent.
I think when we were sitting in that cafe, and I was terrified, the fact that you were so earnest and humble talking about stories, I remember just crying in that cafe and thinking, this is like my baby, and I could give my baby to you and you would do it justice. What is that like when you're meeting somebody and you're trying to decide, I'm going to invest blood, sweat, and tears to create something? What was that like for you?
Well, it started with the book. You know, I had gone through a sort of a tough time for myself, and I was looking for a reason to not just make a movie. I wanted it to mean something to me. I wanted it to mean something to other people. I wanted to do something that had a purpose to it. Everything else, I was in sort of a tailspin of I'm not feeling like I've had any effect or any purpose. And I read this book because of Dan Levine and Tracy Durning. I was sharing an office with Dan, and he gave me this book. And I just was so inspired by the letters, the journal entries, and the voices. And I thought, this is a reason to make a movie. So meeting you, for me, was about how do I serve this? How do I serve this best? And clearly, from the outset, it was going to be about the kids more than it was going to be about you.
I'm glad you said that, because I remember there was a part of me thinking, there doesn't even need to be a teacher role. Like, why does there need to even be a teacher protagonist? Because it's not about me. So for you, the duality of having these two parallel stories, you saw it before I saw it. I thought you could actually make a movie without the teacher.
No.
And you saw otherwise.
No, the process that you brought them through and how much you cared and the obstacles that you had to overcome to serve them, that was the inspiring, at least half of the inspiring story. And then all the efforts that they made, of course, and their transformation couldn't have happened without you. So it had to be about all of you, about a family that is created out of distrust and anger and violence. You know, I remember you describing how that classroom was divided into territories, and then you just stepped into it with your pearls and your bright optimism and transformed it. It was pretty incredible.
The one thing that was so pleasantly surprised is from the very beginning, you included us in the process. So for teachers who believe that writing is a process, that one draft is never enough, can you talk about how many different times that you sat down to draft and rework this incredible screenplay?
Oh, I think I wrote about 11 drafts because there was so much material. And at first, the process for me is you take the book and it becomes like an outline. You read it and you see if there's a movie there. And then it is. Okay, so now I'm going to write it. So I read the book again. And that's when I make all the marks. And then I say, well, I'm using this. I'm not using that. I can cut to that. This is the second act. This is the first act. And then my first draft is basically putting the book into script form. And all a first draft has to do is exist. It's not going to be good. It's just going to be a first draft, because then you can build and then you can work on it. You can't work on everything that's ethereal. So you get your first draft and then you coats of paint. Then you keep structuring it and sculpting it and keep rewriting it and rewriting it. It's all about rewriting. And then talking with you and what was honest and what was authentic and also what was dramatic. There's so much drama in the book. I didn't have to make anything up, but it's how you tell the story, what comes after what, to make a dramatic story build and have it some emotional weight to it. I worry about the script the entire time. It's like the directing and the camera and all that stuff is wonderful fun. You have a great crew and it's creative and you plan ahead and you get all those. But I'm always concerned that the foundation, the script, is still not good enough. So it took, like I said, almost over 11 drafts. And I wanted to include you all the way just to make sure I was respecting it and telling the truth.
And do you let actors ad-lib ever?
Yes. The best thing a writer can have for me, best thing a screenwriter can have is a smart actor. Smart actor who asks smart questions and say, well, what about this? What about that? Then I'll go back and I'll rewrite it accordingly and then makes it better. Because once an actor gets inside a part, in a way, they know the character as well, sometimes better than you do. And you got to ask them then, what you know, is this true? Is this not true? So I like to keep that creative relationship going on. It's fun. And it makes it all about the movie. It's not about any ego. It's just about how do we make the movie the best thing, the thing that you're creating, the product. How do we make that? And if everybody's on the team looking for that, it's one of the greatest experiences.
One question I get asked every audience, whether it's teachers or students, how real is it? And I always say like 98.9%. Yeah. I mean, it's exquisite. For me, what was a proud mom moment is the times that you actually galvanize the Freedom Writers and would share the screenplay, because I know how vulnerable that is to write and then share.
But it was their words. They were kind of co-writing in a way, because all the letters and the journals and stuff and the interviews I had with them were them. They're their words. I wanted them to, you know, hear. And I needed to hear, because I had to fill in all the parts that weren't in the book, the parts that happened. But, of course, from memory, everybody couldn't say, well, I said this or that. So I had to come up with all the scenes in the classroom, especially, that led to your galvanization, you know, what you did. And that took a lot of interviews and listening.
And that's, I think, what was amazing is the Freedom Writers trusted you to bear their soul. And then as a testament, the film was able to bear witness to their story.
And I opened up. You know, you think you're a liberal, and I completely have no idea how deep things go and what a different experience it is. I remember there's one part in particular, the character, you're trying to get through to them. And a character says, but why should I listen to you? Why should I trust you? You could be lying to me up there.
Mario. Beautiful Mario.
And that experience from my childhood is I just automatically thought that the teacher knew everything. And it never occurred to me that that would be, you know, an issue.
And that was Henry Jones.
That was Henry. That's right. Why should I trust you? You could be lying to me up there. You could be a bad person up there. And suddenly the idea of self-protection from the street to the classroom, it just made it so. There was something very inspiring about that.
When you had the opportunity to share the story, I remember the first time we were we were at the Peninsula Hotel, and you were reading me drafts, and I was sitting at the table, literally inconsolable sobbing. And at one moment, you had to get up and go to the bathroom, and this woman sitting across from me thought that you were divorcing me. And she came up, and she said, oh, honey, I'm so sorry, and she brought me like a handkerchief, and I said, we're not getting a divorce. He's reading me my life, and it is flashing before my eyes. What is that like to have known that, like, I nailed it, like the perfect 10.
Well, again, you know, I'm reminded of what Renee said in her interview with you. Like, it doesn't matter what I feel, it matters that people hear it. And what mattered to me is that it landed, that I connected with you. And to me, that was the blessing to go ahead, you know, because if that didn't work, I wouldn't be able to make it. If you weren't connected to it, if I didn't tell the truth.
For our listeners who are movie connoisseurs, every female actress at that time wanted to be in a Richard Le Gravenet's film, because you get women having very substantive roles of feeling like, I don't have to be the love interest. I don't have to be the waitress. I don't have to be that stereotypical female role. Mm-hmm. And so immediately the laundry list of women who wanted to be in this film was unbelievably astounding to me, because I'm like this ordinary person not even wanting to have a female lead in the film. But I'll never forget you said something to the effect of, who would you like to play you? Kind of facetiously as a joke. Mm-hmm. And I blurted out Hilary Swank.
You know, we went through a couple of studios, and when we finally found our home, Hilary, I'll never forget it, she met me in a restaurant here in New York and was crying at the lunch, because it meant so much to her because of her own education and her own background, and she struggled a great deal. She doesn't come from a lot, Hillary, and she's had to fight for everything she's ever had. And it meant so much for her to do this. And I remember she was up for an Oscar for Million Dollar Baby, and it was the Thursday before the Oscars, and she says, if I win this Oscar, she says, I'll commit, I'll make this happen. And she did.
I think shortly after you met with her, I got a call from her on my cell phone. I didn't recognize the number, and she had just met with you.
Yeah.
And through that call, was so thankful that you and I had fought for her. And I'll never forget, she said, I have to go because I have to go get a dress. It was like 2 days before the Oscars. And I said, Hillary, you're going to win. And she said, no, and she named all the other nominees and she deferred to them. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I just have this feeling you're going to win. And she did.
And she did.
And then I remember you and I having dinner with her and her husband at the time, Chad Lowe. Mm-hmm. And it was like not feeling good enough, smart enough, and not realizing that she also didn't.
Oh, she felt the same way. She definitely, yeah, we all felt the same way.
How did you know that she was the one? In my mind, she was perfect.
Perfect.
But how did you know that she would be perfect?
It's just an instinct. It's an energy thing about her. Her passion and her earnest desire to achieve, how much she cares about her work, the way she speaks. She just reminded me of you. She embodied you to me.
She really, when you're talking, she studies you. And
yes, she does.
She fixates on the trait. So there's some eerie moments in the film that I do feel like I'm looking in the mirror.
Yeah, she's an extraordinary actress. Her work is so clean and disciplined and at the same time emotional and very passionate.
My dad, I remember you met my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad got really cocky and would cast himself. He wanted to be Jack Nicholson. He wanted to be Robert Redford. It was always some hotshot actor. And then he passed away.
Mm.
But I love that you chose someone who is a father.
Scott Klein. Yeah.
Who also has a daughter who's a teacher. So tell me what that was like in honor of my dad having Scott Glenn.
Scott Glenn's a wonderful, wonderful man. Such a solid man and a good man. And I my only regret is that I couldn't have put more scenes. I had to cut some stuff back because we had so much material. I wanted more of him in there. But he's like the guy you want him to be your dad. You know, even in The Leftovers, I loved him as the crazy father. I wanted him to be my father.
With the warm and the tequila and Urban Cowboy.
Oh, he's amazing. He's just he's an amazing guy.
I want to talk about some of the behind-the-scenes stuff that our viewers wouldn't know. I love that we had so many real teenagers.
But we didn't cast actors. I mean, Mario was the closest to an actor and...
April Hernandez. Fireball April.
Oh, Fireball. She's a wonderful actress. But the rest, I think we saw over 150 kids. A lot of them, they were not actors.
Kids living in cars.
Hunter.
Kids are homeless.
Hunter Parrish was an actor. So we had three. Well, Mario really wasn't an actor. He was a singer, you know. But the rest of them were all like an open call kind of thing. And I remember we went through pairing different ones in different groups to see, because it wasn't just about who's right for each individual part. It's like, if he's right for this part, I have to have the person next to him be the right person for that group. And if not, I mean, you have to take this person from this group and put him in that group. And it was all sort of interchanging that. That took a very, very long time. I decided with the book that I would have 11 characters be the core, but the classroom had to be filled with over 30. And so we had all those extras who were also playing individual characters in a way. And then out of the 11, there were going to be those highlighted five, because there was a lot of stories to tell. So it took a long time with these open calls. But I have to give credit. What happened in the movie, everyone, including the crew, felt so connected to this and were so... I've never experienced this on a movie set before. My assistant director, Don Sparks, one of the greatest men in the world, and your assistant director is the guy next to you. He's your right arm. He controls the set. He gets everything ready. He's the one timing. The crew is under his power. And he's this big bear of a guy, the most loving guy. He gives everybody nicknames, Don. But he's also fierce. You don't screw with him. And he took it upon himself, because in filmmaking, as a director, I'm not allowed to give direction to extras. But I needed all these 28 other extras to be real characters for Hillary and for the other actors, because your whole class was Freedom Writers. And Don took it upon himself to take all the extras on his own, and he started them writing journals throughout the process. And they started doing their own Freedom Writer journals as they were making the film. And I remember... we would shoot Hillary, her side, and she came up to me and going, they're all crying, they're all acting. And I had to go up and tell them, no, you have to save it, the camera's not on you yet. They didn't understand that we had to turn around, and they were giving Hillary everything they could. We became such a group that I had these little awards made for the extras, and I had a ceremony where I gave them each an acting award at the end, because they were so incredible. I've never seen kids care that much, and extras care that much. And it was such a wonderful experience for all of them. They bonded really beautifully, and the actors going through it too. I remember taking the actors to the Museum of Tolerance and their experience of playing that and going through the exact same thing that the Freedom Writers went through.
So we still work with all of the wonderful Holocaust survivors, and as they are 94, 93, and 91 respectively.
Wow.
These beautiful women, Gloria, Elizabeth,
Gloria,
and
I remember
Renee.
Gloria. Yeah.
Oh, It's hard for me because I've worked with these women for over 20 years. And
they're so eager to tell their stories, too. That was the hardest day, one of the hardest days of shooting for me. And that was just my inexperience because we were shooting on film. This was before digital. So in a film, you know, canister, it's 11 minutes long. And then you have to change the reels. The film runs out. So I wanted them to just tell their stories. And I was just shooting each one of them. And I just had the camera run. But I didn't realize that when the film ran out, I had to say cut. And I couldn't say cut to what they were saying because they were telling these Holocaust stories, and we would all just wait patiently until they were finished. It was a hard, you know, I didn't know how else to do it.
I think an anecdote you'll love is Renee was actually with a group of students that had gone on the March of the Living. So they'd gone to Poland, and then from Poland they were going to go to Israel. So on this plane. And in the middle of the flight, the Freedom Riders is on. And the pilot gets on the announcement and the flight attendants and everybody's hooting and hollering. And Renee said, you know, 50 years ago, someone would have told me when I left Auschwitz that I would be going to Israel getting the hero's welcome.
Wow.
And you did that for her. Imagine being above the sky and having people hoot and holler for you.
That's wonderful. That makes me happy.
So there's a couple things that were hard for me. I did not realize by asking my students that they had to bear their story, that I too had to bear my story. Because in the Freedom Riders diary, I don't really do as much behind the scenes.
Right.
And so there was a few things that you had to humanize with me that that I was really uncomfortable with. One being my detractors. It was daunting to realize that there had to be this portrayal of people who just did not like what I did or who I was.
But that was important to show what the obstacles that you had to overcome, and also to tell the story of what's out there, the outlook that's out there, how these kids are perceived, but just shoving them through the system without any education.
And I think the woman you cast, Imelda Staunton,
She put herself on tape in London and sent it to me, and that's how we cast her.
She's incredible. And she was so nervous because she's in all the Harry Potter films as well. Mm-hmm. So to be this woman who's so dear and precious.
She's wonderful. One of the funniest
she's
women.
She's like vilified. Like every time kids see her, they cringe. But there's a scene where she's so mad and she's literally shaking.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of my favorite moments.
Yeah,
because she's a great actress. Because she channels that anger and that disdain.
That small-mindedness.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Which leads me to the toughest question. Whenever I do Q&A at a school, I always know their first question, was your husband that bad? I don't know why, but people get very defensive and protective of Hillary as protagonist. And it's a moment of a pause for me when I know there's a Q&A, because I know I'm going to get asked about my dad. And I'm going to get asked about my ex-husband. And you and I went round and round about that. I wasn't sure what and how should or should not be in this film. But I knew that you would get what you needed. And I wasn't ready to give it to you. So what's that like when you need something and your protagonist does not play along? I was guarded and protected.
You were. You were. And I did the best I could with it, tried to make it as safe as possible, because I know there was private stuff that didn't need to be dramatized, but we needed to understand what sacrifices you made and the problems that you were facing. So I tried to approach what you would give me. I tried to approach that with the idea that everybody has their reasons. Nobody's wrong. Nobody needs to be villainized. You know, sometimes just things just don't work out. You know, you found this calling that took you on this amazing journey, and he wasn't a part of it. And it doesn't make him wrong. He just wanted a different life and didn't sign on for that. So I tried to make it as even-handed as possible, because that's what happens in a real marriage. Sometimes it just doesn't work out.
There's two lines in that exchange that will get like an audible ooh from the audience. I can't be your wife. And when he says, you like the idea of me, and I say, but it's such a good idea. To have someone like Patrick Dempsey.
He was on Grey's Anatomy.
Grey's Anatomy. Mm-hmm. Dr. McDreamy.
He was wonderful to work with.
He was wonderful.
He really was.
There was that backstory of Hillary going through the demise of her marriage.
During our shooting.
Yes. Yeah. And so that scene.
It was very personal for a lot of people. Yeah.
She's making this film going through something that should have been very private.
Yes.
That became very public. And it became very public during the shoot.
During the shoot, yeah.
And so that scene where there is that exchange and she's so emotional, she told me later that it was her channeling everything that she was going through in her own personal
life. One felt like a voyeur a little bit with that, and you didn't want to take advantage of it too much, so I didn't do a lot of takes of it. But with Hillary, you don't have to do a lot of takes. She gives you everything on the first two, pretty much. But she's very exposed and very honest. She just shows you what she's feeling.
As a writer and also a director, is there things that you feel is a mandate or you would die on a sword for that you would not cut because the studio says you have to? Or have you ever had those kind of battles where you're
On Freedom Writers,
the darling boy during the Toast for Change scene, who was not Zac Efron, who does not have washboard
abs.
Oh,
no, but he had to be. He was
but
the most.
That.
No, absolutely. I think they wanted me to either shorten or cut that long monologue. That was one of the most honest things in the whole movie. He was such a non-actor. He was really talking from his heart. And I don't know if you remember, but a lot of the kids who played the parts had similar lives.
They had been homeless, or they had been to rehab.
They really, it all kind of came out. It was such an extraordinary experience working with them.
I think the first time we felt like maybe we were onto something, we were here in New York, and we were near Chinatown, and there was this person that was selling like bootleg copies. And the film wasn't out yet, and there was a bootleg copy of Freedom Writers. It was probably someone had put a jacket over a camera in a screening, and we felt like we'd arrived.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to the studio, but I love when a kid finds the film and they've seen it 20 or 30 times. Having kids say, like, this saved me from a dark place,
or this
spoke to me. Mm. So as a writer and a creator, what does that mean to create something?
That means a great deal to me. I can't tell you what that means to me. Like I said, the initial thing was, I want to do something that means something. I want to do something because there's a reason to do it. And if that's true, what you're telling me, then it was accomplished, and that means everything to me.
I think we talked about going back to that very first meeting at that cafe and our favorite moments in film. And I said, I just want people to see this film, and it's not enough. They have to go and get a cup of coffee and keep talking about it. So is there a moment that you wanted to talk about after you shot it or you wrote it that you're like, this is a moment that's going to resonate with somebody, whether it was the line game or the Toast for Change or just a moment where you could step back and say, I think I got it.
I really think it's that monologue where he steps forward.
Toast for Change.
Yeah, and Marcus has tears in his eyes.
Yeah.
And that wasn't, I didn't ask him for that. He just did, the kid. And he's not an actor. And he came forward and hugged him. Mm. I couldn't believe we caught that.
You also caught, for our listeners that don't know, Mario's backstory. From Baltimore, his mom was unfortunately a drug addict.
Yeah.
But he wanted to use this film to get her clean. The scene with the one and only F word, when Hillary is confronting him, he also cried. And that wasn't in the screenplay. So explain that, because I remember
stuff.
You calling me and saying, oh my God, Aaron, you got to come and see this.
Yeah, that scene, he did a beautiful job on that. And again, he wasn't a trained actor, but he was so honest. He was so in it. We were really lucky. We cast it really. And again, I want to just emphasize April Hernandez gave a gorgeous performance. I think she was sort of the center of the actors. She was the core, you know, of the actors. And her beating heart and her passion and her beautiful scenes in the classroom really was the spine of the cast, I think.
So when you want to leave a legacy, how do you do it as a filmmaker who's had every role from writing to directing to producing?
To me, it's still about the writing and putting the words and images together. But it starts with words for me and ideas. I don't think about legacy. Just the next thing and the next thing. And, you know, I'm attracted to those kind of stories. People do amazing things, you know, just amazing things.
For you, you had a daughter that was going through high school when you were making this film.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And we met her when she was young.
Yeah, and my nephew who became a teacher.
One of our first Freedom Art teachers,
that's
John
right,
Paul.
John Paul.
What was that like for you that now it was personal, that we're friends and you've got your beloved JP who's a part of our teacher program, or your daughter may have to read this in a class?
It meant a lot. I've never had work bleed into the personal like that before, with a purpose. With a reason for being, something that elevated. I mean, you helped my nephew tremendously. He was such a dedicated teacher, and he was being just beaten up by the system, who loved his students. He was very much like you, and you lifted him and gave him hope and gave him a way through it.
I loved every time I went to his school. He would start the year, and he would buy like 35 Freedom Art Diaries, and by June there'd be three left. And I love that. I was like, I love the fact that kids are stealing this book.
Mm-hmm.
Wait till they see the movie. So this June, the Freedom Riders, it's their 20th anniversary for graduating. And we realize that family is what we choose, and we've chosen to stay together all these years. Wonderful. So all those beautiful faces you met 2 decades ago are still very much storytellers. Mm-hmm. So what would you say to Freedom Riders?
Just thank you for letting me tell your stories and to keep on keeping on. Right now, more than ever, they're necessary. I mean, what happened in that classroom is an example of what should be happening in this country, where people come together that are divided and are full of hate and ignorance and prejudice, and they overcome it, and look what they can be.
So if you were to give a call to action for a young kid who's like you, that you were that kid from Brooklyn, for you, telling stories was your ticket out, of whatever that out you needed, what kind of advice would you give to a kid who's got a story to tell or has an active imagination or sees images in their head like you did?
I want kids today to dream again. I feel like everybody's being so careful, afraid of missing out, afraid of committing to something because they'll miss out on something else. But if they have those stories and those images, nowadays with a phone, you can create them. You can go after them and tell your story. Put yourself on camera or your friends. You have to do it. You can't just talk about it and dream about it. You gotta apply it. Writing for me was a way out of my head and out of pain and out of the past. Still is. So I've encouraged kids to write and to dream and to create their images. It's funny, I had dinner last night with a writer who does a workshop on memoir writing. And she says, even someone who is not a writer has that one story in them, has that one book in them. And it really is just about telling your story and being willing to tell your story, because everybody's got one. And it does contribute in some way. I think that's what it is. It's knowing that you have a story and kind of owning your narrative and taking care of it. And that's what the Freedom Writers say. That's what the book is about. And when they speak of their own stories and their own pain, that's their truth.
In honor of their truth, may we all own our narrative. This concludes our show this week. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Serrier, with production assistance from Clay Amontorp. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with your friends and leave us a review. Help us spread the word, share hope, and most importantly, help us pass the message of freedom so that we can lift, we can learn, and we can live our stories to the fullest. Our call to action today is this. May we all keep on keeping on. May we find and tell our own stories. And as our guest Richard encouraged, may we all dream again. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.